Welcome back. Joining us now, as he is so kind to do every Monday at the bottom of the second hour, almost, is Mark Thornton. Mark is a doctor of economics over at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Are y'all able to sit up and take nourishment now after the big loss of the championship game?
Oh, yes. Everything's back to normal, except, of course, it's Dr. Martin Luther King Day that we're celebrating, so the students are still asleep, and we're busy at work here at the Mises Institute.
Hey, I had a couple of listener emails. And let me ask you a couple of questions. As a doctor of economics, from a free market perspective.
Okay.
If the people at the front of the spigot, the government and then the banks, are the first to benefit from inflation, who are the first to benefit from deflation?
Well, that's a very good question. The major beneficiaries of deflation are going to be your consumers, who are going to be, and we're talking about declining prices here rather than a declining money supply, but, you know, declining prices are going to help consumers first and foremost. You know, you can imagine that if we hit a deflationary period, you know, you'd probably see sharply falling housing prices, for example. So people who were in the market to start a family and to, you know, buy a house, those people would be seeing good prices. And so consumers benefit. That's a good thing. Savers would benefit as well. Even if you weren't getting any interest on your money, your money would still have greater purchasing power the longer you held it through a deflationary period. And so with a positive rate of interest, savers would be enhanced as a result, and also the saving process would also be encouraged, which would be a great thing, because that's savings is the building block of economic growth and prosperity. And so that's another great thing. And eventually, producers would have to adapt from an inflationary environment with low interest rates to a deflationary environment with market-determined rates. And once they made the adjustment, you know, it would help productive activities. And, of course, producers and entrepreneurs are the primary productive activities in the economy. So that sector, that group would also benefit. You know, the Fed inflating the money supply is basically fueling unproductive bubble-like activities which are not the primary interests of consumers but are misdirected resources. And so, you know, a deflation, Austrians view deflation as the normal process of the marketplace, as economic growth and productivity outpace the growth in the money supply in the sense of gold and silver in the economy. So now, of course, you can have dramatic deflations, which cause a lot of distortions and problems. But ultimately, even those severe forms of deflations are really the economy trying to get back to normal, trying to get back to a stable equilibrium where resources are being directed in a harmonious way to where consumers want them. So deflation helps consumers, it helps savers, and ultimately it helps the productive side of the economy.
Well, then also it harms the banks because they're being repaid in ever-increasing, well, I don't know, does it really hurt the banks with their accounts receivables?
Well, it depends. In the short run, it's going to hurt banks probably. In the long run, it's, you know, banks can adjust to this. So in the short term, if you go from an inflationary economy to a deflationary economy, there's going to be a lot of disruptions because the central bank's inflation is stimulating bubble activities that only exist because of the inflation. And so once you stop that inflation and you embark on a price deflationary process or period, there's going to be a lot of adjustments that have to take place. But ultimately, banks do fine under deflationary environment. I mean, we had a deflationary environment through almost the entire 19th century, And, you know, banks did just fine. U.S. banks became world-leading banks. America became an economic superpower. So, you know, some people have reason to fear deflation. Ben Bernanke fears it. Paul Krugman fears it. Wall Street, in a sense, fears deflation because they learn to live off of cheap credit. And so there are people who fear deflation, whether it's rationally so in their self-interest or just irrational fear, phobia. But ultimately, the normal process of a free market economy without a central bank and on a gold or silver standard would be a slow, steady deflation in the economy so that the goods you buy become cheaper and cheaper over time. And we can see this in our own economy, even though it's, you know, heavily influenced by the central bank. But if we look at flat screen TVs or computers or iPhones, what we see is a very fast pace of economic development. And as a result of that fast pace of economic development, we can tangibly see the prices of those goods falling and the quality increasing over time. That's what Austrian economists want for everybody and for all goods in the economy.
So initially, a deflation would harm the banks, probably spook the government, Wall Street. And yet those are the people who are always telling us to be fearful of deflation and have targeted inflation rate. And recently, you know, just like two or three days ago, Bloomberg had some bozo put out a op-ed, you know, talking about, well, you know, inflation was stubbornly below the Fed's target. And I still always question, when did their supposed mandate of stable prices turn into a mandate of a stable rate of inflation? I mean, I missed that meeting, and I did not get that memo.
Well, you know, it's it took place over a very long period of time, and it's in part due to the influence of academic mainstream economists who also have this fear of deflation, and now it's an outright phobia. You know, the experience in Japan, for example, where they basically had stable prices, they haven't had much deflation at all. But the recent government that was elected ran on a platform of fighting deflation and of creating, you know, a target rate of inflation, a mandated rate of inflation in the economy. So that's the general mainstream view of things. But, you know, if you go back to our childhood, for example, prices were stable and slowly declining in the U.S., and we had the highest standard of living in the world and one of the fastest growth rates in the world. So stable money and stable prices or declining prices are perfectly in line with the goals of stability and economic growth and economic development. What the mainstream inflation targeters are after is that they want money to depreciate over time. They want to be able to inject additional amounts of money into the economy on a continuous basis. It helps the government. You know, they get to pay back their government bonds with depreciated currency. They get to help their friends on Wall Street. They get to keep their hand pressed down on interest rates in the economy, which helps certain interest groups, namely the banks, and also to a certain extent real estate and Wall Street. You know, anybody will tell you if interest rates go down, the value of capital assets goes up, real estate goes up, stock prices go up. And so there's a, you know, if you have the ear of the central bank, like the banks and Wall Street do, they want that downward pressure on the interest rate, and they don't want to rely on savers to do it. They want the government to provide the money to them. They don't want to have to go out and, you know, negotiate with savers and pay them a decent rate of interest.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton. Mark is with the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. That's MISES.org. Mark and I will be back on the other side of the break. I assume you've got time for another segment or two, Mark?
Absolutely, Alan. We'd love to do it.
Remember, MISES.org. They have, I've already used the word plethora, they have a whole mess of free material on that website. Mark and I will be back on the other side of the break. This episode of Bubba and Butler is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other MP3 player. For the listeners of Bubba and Butler, Audible is offering an audiobook download at no charge, along with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. While Bubba personally recommends Liar's Poker, Rising from the Ashes of Wall Street, my recommendation is The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. This is a great starting point for anyone wanting to learn about the Federal Reserve and our debt-based monetary system. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download either of these books at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Bubba. What have you got to lose? It's a free 30-day trial. Sign up at audibletrial.com/Bubba and get either Liar's Poker or The Creature from Jekyll Island at no charge. audibletrial.com/Bubba.
The American Veterans Center needs your help to preserve and protect our veterans' legacy so future generations will remember their service and sacrifice. You can help the center accomplish this with a gift of $25. For your support, you'll receive a free DVD titled World War II Remembered. Just go to AmericanVeteransCenter.org and click the donate button. That's AmericanVeteransCenter.org.
I'm Alan Butler. Like millions of other Americans, I'm an insulin-resistant type 2 diabetic. But being diabetic hasn't kept me from enjoying my favorite foods because I discovered Waylo. There are a lot of artificial sweeteners out there, but the only one I use is Waylo. It's all natural, no chemicals, and unlike a lot of those processed sweeteners, Waylo tastes exactly like sugar. You can't tell the difference. And if you're into baking like I am, you'll be happy to know that Waylo browns like sugar and bakes like sugar. Waylo has 75% fewer calories than sugar and, more importantly, an 80% lower glycemic index. So whether you're on a diet or simply health conscious, Waylo gives you the benefits of sugar without the adverse side effects. Right now, if you order online at Waylo.com and enter in the coupon code Butler, you'll get a 10% discount and free shipping on orders of $75 or more. Enjoy the foods you love today without the side effects. Waylo, WHEYLOW.com. It truly is the only sweetener I use.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
Motown.
Nothing wrong with Motown, and it is Motown Monday. I was just explaining to Mark, you know, every day when Mark and I are together, it's always on Monday, and as you know, we do Motown Mondays, so when Mark blasts out these interviews, they probably, the folks following Mark and the Mises Institute probably think Motown's all we do. So, all right, Mark, from the Austrian perspective, I mean, clearly we're in the economic doldrums, despite the fact that if you looked at the official GDP, the official narrative, the economy has never been better. I mean, you know, which is hard to believe that nobody's picking up on that, but the GDP is, I mean, we're in record territory, just like the S&P, but 79% of the American people, at least, know that we're still in a recession. What, from the Austrian perspective, can we do to turn this economy around? Or can it be turned around at this point?
Well, it certainly can be turned around, but we're doing so many things wrong now with the economy that it would take a great amount of effort and change to get the ship turned around completely around and moving in the right direction. We have a budget of the national government that's not anywhere close to being balanced, and it's very, very large. We have a central bank with a zero interest rate policy with quantitative easing. That's completely wrong. The Austrians advocate a balanced budget at a very low level with a central bank that's not manipulating the money supply, that's not manipulating interest rates. In addition to that, the Austrians recommend just what the classical school of economics recommends, is for the government to get out of the way and let the market heal itself. Okay, so the market has a self-correcting mechanism where it can eliminate all these bubble activities, unproductive activities in the economy, and focus resources where they truly are needed the most. And so we want to see very low or no taxation in the economy. We want to see a very small government in the economy. We'd rather just get rid of the Federal Reserve entirely. And most importantly, we have to deregulate the economy so that government isn't interfering with this corrective process. And right now, the American economy is more regulated than it has ever been in history. We've got the Dodd-Frank financial regulations, which are screwing up the banking industry, making it difficult to get loans, and freezing the banks giving money, lending money to the productive sector of the economy, to small businesses, for example. And then we have Obamacare that's being implemented, which is screwing up the healthcare industry even more than it was screwed up under, you know, the previous sets of regulations and subsidies and monopolies. For example, you know, what the Austrians would like to see in healthcare is for the monopoly over doctor services to be eliminated so that you'd have more competition for doctors. And, you know, and look at, you know, if you go to a doctor, you have to wait. It's very expensive. There's always the insurance business. You have to have an appointment. It's just ridiculous. And if you went to your vet, of course, you don't need an appointment. You just walk in, you get the service, and you're out of there. The bill is like $40. That's because there's no monopoly on veterinarians. And so we'd like to get rid of that kind of monopoly. We'd like to get rid of the pharmaceutical patents monopoly. We'd like to get rid of the monopoly that hospitals have where they can prevent competitors from coming into their territories. And so the healthcare industry is all bollocksed up by government monopolies in every sphere of healthcare. And as a result, we have poor quality service and very high cost, increasingly difficult to obtain healthcare services, and at a much lower quality than the market would provide. So that's the kind of thing we'd like Austrians would like to do systematically throughout the economy, is to eliminate those monopolies, eliminate those regulations, and let the market determine how things are produced and what prices they will be produced at.
You know, it's not just the vets that don't have to deal with the government, but the LASIK surgery, you know, that market's pretty much unfettered. And that's why a procedure that was once very expensive can now be done for a few hundred bucks in relatively short period of time. Plastic surgery is another classic example where the government's not in there interfering with everything, and plastic surgery has dropped, although I do think there are a lot of them that shouldn't be getting it.
Yes, I know. A few years ago, I checked into LASIK surgery, and I went in. I knew the guy, and he let me right in, didn't need an appointment. And this is a very big clinic that does a lot of different patients. And he said, yeah, you're a good candidate for LASIK surgery. And I said, well, I don't think I can afford it, because I thought it was going to be like $2,000 or $3,000. It turned out to be less than half of that because the prices had fallen so much. I said, well, I can't really do it today, you know, thinking that, you know, there was all this aftercare that had to take place. And he said, well, you know, you'll be fine by tomorrow morning. You can go to work. And so the price had fallen, the quality had improved in just a few short years. And I said, well, okay. I said, well, I'll make an appointment. He said, don't, we can do it right now. And so, you know, the service was great. The price was greatly reduced. The quality of the service was much better. And that was only after a few years. You know, I'd sort of checked into it about 7 or 8 years ago, I guess, and then 3 years after that, and so much had changed. And there's absolutely no barriers to entry into that field, and very little government regulation. And basically everybody that I was there with at that LASIK surgery clinic was very happy with the results. And, of course, you go back, you know, for additional checkups, and I saw many of the same people that I saw that day were there on my other visits, you know, and everybody was extremely happy with the procedure. And, you know, you just never get that kind of result from other doctors. I had a friend who went in to see a heart surgeon that he was a patient of. He said his appointment was for 9:30 in the morning, and he didn't leave the doctor's office until 1:30 that day. You know, and so that's the kind of care you get from a government-controlled sector. And the LASIK sector is completely ungovernment-controlled, and you get so much better results there than you do with a sector that's, you know, has all those deep government controls and monopolies.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that, for example, those certificates of need, let's say you and I wanted to open up an MRI facility over in Auburn. We actually have to go to the government and get permission, and then we have to produce a certificate of need showing that Auburn needs another MRI facility. And it's nothing but crony capitalism.
Yeah, and the main component of getting that certificate of need is that the other producers in the area, the other hospitals in the area, have to agree to it. And so the person you're competing against, or the institution you're competing against, gets to weigh in on whether or not you get to locate within a certain distance of that hospital. You can imagine if restaurants had that same monopoly power, where they got to sit on a board that determined whether or not McDonald's or Burger King or some other restaurant got the right to locate down the street from you. The monopoly power would be significant, and prices would be much higher, quality of service would be much lower, and, you know, it's something that benefits the incumbent firms, gives them monopoly power, and hurts the entrepreneurs who are trying to get into business, and, of course, most importantly, it hurts the consumer.
Isn't that nutty? I mean, I think these are the sort of things that if people knew and understood, to borrow Henry Ford's comment about if they knew about the Federal Reserve, we'd have a revolution while morning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and there's so much of that. That's why I say, you know, this it's systematic government throughout. You know, if environmentalists, for example, if they realized that we use up as much gasoline, as many gallons of gasoline to produce ethanol to put back into the gasoline, you know, they wouldn't support something like that. They wouldn't support ethanol requirements in gasoline if they knew that we were just wasting a bunch of oil and gas and gasoline, you know, with tractors and with fertilizer and all the rest. You know, we're simply unaware of the negative effects that government brings about. The only thing that the average citizen is told, unless they're listening to your show or going to Mises.org, is that, oh, ethanol saves the environment, you know, things of that nature. Oh, government is regulating doctors, so that must mean the quality is better, when the exact opposite is always the case. They're never told those secondary, unseen, unintended consequences of government involvement in the economy.
Mark, do you think that the Fed's policies right now are what are holding back this economy, and that's why we don't have a recovery, despite the official narrative that we're in the roaring 20-teens?
Yep, there's no doubt about it in my mind. Keeping the zero interest rate policy and keeping the quantitative easing policy are actually a drag on the economy. What we need is positive market-determined interest rates, and the Fed is keeping its foot on the neck of the American saver. So if the Fed were to relax their policy and allow interest rates to rise, that would induce savers to put more money in the bank. Those higher interest rates would also encourage bankers to lend money to productive firms out there, to credit quality worthy companies and entrepreneurs. And also, by eliminating quantitative easing and telling the government, having the central bank tell the government, we're no longer going to pay your bills for you. You have to pay your bills for the American taxpayer. That would be a strong message to Congress to say, let's balance the budget. Let's get this national debt under control. So what the Fed is doing is all wrong. It's not helping anybody except unproductive bubble activities. It's helping Wall Street. It's helping the leverage up the hedge funds and related investments. And, you know, and so if you take away this central bank stimulus, it's going to hurt some of those firms, some of those government-connected companies and institutions. But for the productive economy, for savers and entrepreneurs, it's going to be a boom.
Yeah, I don't see how buying toxic mortgage-backed securities from a handful of banks and then paying them interest not to lend the money out is supposed to help the economy at large. Hey, we're going to take a break. This is Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. When Mark and I come back, we're going to discuss some of Mark's favorite stuff, the Civil War, but also what the tax revenues were supposed to look like when this country first started. We'll be back on the other side of the break.
Hey, everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. And I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
Hi, this is Tom Woods. Join me for the Tom Woods Show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern right here on Liberty Express Radio.
They say you get what you pay for, meaning the less you pay, the less you get. Not necessarily true. For instance, a lot of people pay less for car insurance by switching to Geico, but get more than savings. They get satisfaction. In fact, Geico's customer satisfaction is at 97%. And that explains why I nearly got stepped on by some happy customers dancing in the street.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com to see how much you could save. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I'm Charles Goyette, and you're listening to the Liberty Express.
Who are those guys?
Welcome back to the final segment of today's show, and joining us still is, as he is most gracious to do, is Dr. You should check out the Mises Institute's website. They got a lot of good stuff. Mark is also an historian in addition to being a doctor of economics, and he wrote the book on the history of the Civil War, which he was kind enough to send to me. My father-in-law finally finished it. But Mark, when we were talking last week, my dad, after the show, mention, you know, when this country started off, you know, we didn't have an income tax. In fact, the first couple of attempts at an income tax were knocked down by the Supreme Court. So during the Progressive era, the same year we got the direct election of senators, the creation of the Federal Reserve, we also got a constitutional version of the income tax, even though I think it's probably still unconstitutional. But hey, that's just me. I'm a layman. How was the federal government supposed to get its money when it first got started?
Well, Alan, if you really want to know, if you really want to go back to the original country under the Articles of Confederation, the Continental Congress actually submitted requests to the state government. And so, the Continental Congress would actually sit down and figure out population and size and revenue potential, and then submit to the various states a request for funding, and then the states would have to respond to that, and they usually paid up at least part of the request. And so at that point, the central government was operating on a pretty voluntary type of basis, in which the states really had a lot of control. Now, the Constitution changed that, and the Constitution set up a system where tariffs on imports, or taxes on imports, were to be the primary source of revenue of the national government. And, the Constitution took away the power of the states to impose its own taxes on imports, and it took that authority for itself to give uniform tariffs. And so tariffs, those taxes on imported goods, mostly from Europe, made up over 80% of federal revenue throughout the 19th century. Basically, you know, there were tariffs on imports were about 80% of federal revenue. Excise taxes, primarily on alcohol, made up almost 20% of federal revenue, and then a small percentage of revenue throughout the 19th century was based on land sales. So the Western land sales, where the federal government would sell land to its citizens, made up a small portion of federal revenue. So, you know, basically the federal government at that point was not directly taxing most of the American people. Unless you were a whiskey producer or a consumer, and you weren't buying land out west, the only form of taxation was the indirect taxes that you paid when you bought goods made in foreign countries. And so that was the big question. If you break the government down, the federal government down into revenue raising and then expenditure, well, the revenue raising side, one half of the importance of federal government was related to the tariff. And so politically, the tariff mattered a great deal to Americans, especially prior to the American Civil War.
And it was the dispute over that led us in large part to the Civil War?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at the political battles that existed with the political parties and candidates prior to the American Civil War, you see this ebb and flow of power and the raising and lowering of tariffs. And, you know, you had in 1828 the Tariff of Abominations that, you know, raised tariff rates and, you know, upset a lot of southern states in particular. This was fought against and eventually brought down through political battles in Washington, D.C., as well as at the ballot boxes. And, of course, the inter-party battles where political parties basically positioned themselves. And at the time, of course, we had the Democrat Party and the Whig Party, and then you had a lot of minor parties. And those minor parties would align themselves with their positions on tariffs in order to gain electoral power on a regional basis and to upset other political candidates and to sway the balance of power in the political process. And so this was the main story in American politics prior to the American Civil War was, what were tariff rates going to look like? How uniform were they going to be, in that would they be different from good to good? And what was the level of the tariffs? How much was being extracted from the consumer? And, of course, also, you know, northern industries, textiles, iron producers in the north in particular wanted the protective tariff, because they were producing products such as textiles, iron goods, plows and so forth, cooking utensils, that were directly competing with European producers. And so if you could raise the tariffs on those goods, the domestic producers could also raise their prices and expand their output. Now, that meant that consumers were paying a higher price for those products.
Mark, do you think the reason we got the Federal Reserve and the income tax in the same year was for the central bank to have a way for the federal government to pay all that interest they knew they would soon be making?
Well, it's a good question. The Progressive Era, you know, they had all sorts of legislation that fundamentally changed government and what government did and how it did it. You mentioned the direct election of senators, which took even more power away from state governments. The income tax and the Federal Reserve, of course, are very much related to the funding of government. And, you know, they sort of go hand in hand with one another. And ultimately, both of those institutions would go on to undermine the monetary system of the United States, the gold standard, which finally collapsed its final last gasp, really, in 1971 when Richard Nixon closed the gold window. So the progressives were the American embodiment of socialism. And if you go back to the Communist Manifesto of 1851 and the 10-point program of the Communist Manifesto, it does call for that, for direct taxation. It does call for a central bank that would regulate credit and money. It does call for compulsory public education, and it calls for a lot of things that we have now that we take for granted as part of the American scheme of things, but actually were dreamt up by the socialist and communist Karl Marx, Frederick Engels in the 19th century, and these became part of this progressive thinking in the United States, which was, you know, impacted by a lot of different changes in American society, but there certainly were academic influences at work here as well. As Americans became professionally educated in German and European in German and European universities, they adopted these same sets of institutions that they brought to the United States, and ultimately were able to bring to fruition during the Progressive Era. You know, roughly from 1900 to 1920.
Mark, we're about out of time, buddy. We're down about the 30-second mark. Everything you say makes me think of two or three more questions. I'll end it with this. You know, Madison said one time, tongue-in-cheek, that if we interpreted the Commerce Clause too broadly, we could one day find the federal government in charge of educating our children. And everybody laughed at the absurdity of the suggestion, and that, yet that's what we have today.
Absolutely, Alan. And I encourage everybody to follow me on Twitter, Dr. Mark Thornton on Twitter.
All right, Mark Thornton, this is the Mises Institute. Excuse me, Mises.org. Mark, War Eagle buddy, have a good day.
Thank you very much, Alan. You too.